So our practice really is about freeing our minds from these habits, the deeply conditioned habits that cause suffering. It's habits of mind of greed and attachment, habits of ill will and hatred and aversion. It's a habit of the dream, the sleep of ignorance, of delusion. And all the practices we do, whether it's the practice of mindfulness, of concentration, of loving kindness, of generosity, of ethical conduct, all the practices we do serve this end of freedom. It's what the Buddha called the sure heart's release. Now, one of the unique aspects of the Buddha's teaching, and Carol mentioned this last night, is that it both begins and ends with wisdom. We start the path with a certain understanding of right understanding, of wisdom, and the path culminates in right understanding, in freedom from the defilements. So the question for us is, how do we train in wisdom? This is not a question that is asked very often in our Western cultures. I mean, growing up in school, did we ever hear talk about wisdom and how to live a life of wisdom? Probably not. We can train in this way, and the Buddha's path lays it out very clearly. We can train in wisdom on various levels. And the first step for all of us is, in one way or another, coming close to the teachings, hearing the teachings, learning about them. And then the second and crucial step is putting them into practice. So it's not enough to hear or to read or to understand them intellectually. We need to put the teachings into practice and then see for ourselves whether it leads to greater peace and happiness or not. So during this retreat, we'll be talking about one particular aspect of these wisdom teachings, which the Buddha called the three characteristics. That is, those qualities which characterize all elements of our experience. And I think most of you are familiar with them. They're the characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, which Carol talked about, just the inherently unsatisfying nature of impermanent things. So it's the characteristics of impermanence, of dukkha, unsatisfactoriness, and of selflessness. So tonight I want to emphasize particularly the insight, the transforming insight into impermanence. Suzuki Roshi is a Japanese Zen master who founded the San Francisco Zen Center. And some of you may be familiar with his very wonderful book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. So he was a transforming presence for Buddhism in the West. And someone asked him once, one of his students said, "I've been listening to you for many years, but I still don't understand. Could you please put it in a nutshell? Can you reduce Buddhism to one phrase?" So Suzuki replied, "Everything changes." Now the implications of this statement are enormous. Everything changes. Now what's striking is that this is not a hidden truth. This is not an esoteric truth. If you went up to anybody on the streets of Interlaken and asked, "Do things change?" Everybody would say yes. So we all know it intellectually. But we don't know it fully. We don't know it completely. We don't know it deeply. Because if we really understood in a deep way that everything changes, we wouldn't be clinging. We wouldn't be holding on. and we wouldn't be suffering. Now we can see this so clearly with our changing bodies. If we're attached to them being a certain way or staying a certain way, then when they change, either due to sickness or an accident or just aging, if we're attached to them staying a certain way, then when they change, as they inevitably do, we suffer. It's so simple and uncomplicated. But it's hard. As Munindraji would say, my first teacher, he would say, it's simple but not easy. Right? So it's not a complicated truth. But it's not easy to take it in a very full way. It's quite different and difficult to really see that these changes that we all go through are not mistakes. It's not that we're doing something wrong and our bodies get old. It's just nature. It's the Dharma. It's the way things are. Everything changes. Suzuki Roshi's summation of Buddhism and the implications of that. It's just what happens to everyone, to everything. Years ago, I was teaching a retreat at a wilderness retreat center in New Mexico, where they would run retreats particularly for environmental and social activists. Beautiful place. Both Carol and I have taught there many times. Way out in the middle of this vast wilderness. And after the retreat, we were going for a hike. The last day of the retreat, we were just going for a hike along the river that runs through the ranch. And on the way back, it had rained the day before and the rocks were a bit slippery. So I slipped on one of the rocks and I hyperextended my knee. But it kind of felt okay and I just walked back, and I was giving the Dharma talk that night. And in those days, I was still sitting cross-legged. Things change. And I had the thought before the talk, oh, I better sit in the chair. But I didn't listen to the thought. So I sat cross-legged, giving the talk. An hour later, I couldn't stand. I couldn't put any weight on the leg at all. I had to be carried back. I was a little embarrassing. And then all night long, my mind was just, you know, going on and on with quite a bit of self-judgment. How could I have been so stupid and not careful and all that? And then thinking that I had a very busy summer schedule of teaching. How am I going to manage? I can't walk. Finally, after many, many hours, I was up most of the night, kind of something cleared in my mind. And a little mantra appeared, which really captured the essence of the situation. And it said, anything can happen anytime. Just anything can happen anytime. We don't know. And sometimes people might hear that, anything can happen anytime, and it, you know, maybe they think, oh, that would be a very fearful state. You know, we get very defensive. But it was just the opposite. When I finally acknowledged that anything can happen anytime, there was just a relaxation, an opening to the truth of how things are. That we don't know what's going to happen, and anything can happen anytime. And it resulted in a much easier acceptance of the situation. And of course, my life continued. It was not the end of it. But it was a very important lesson and a deepening of the understanding that everything changes. We don't know how, we don't know when, we don't know in what way, but the truth of change is always present. Seeing impermanence and seeing it deeply and clearly deconditions the deep pattern of clinging, of attachment. But what's so strange is that we're habituated to hold on, to cling, even to states of suffering. And it's quite amazing to watch the mind do this. I remember being on one retreat, and there had been some difficult situation in my life, and I can't even remember now what it was, but I was on retreat, and my mind was just obsessing about it. You know, I caught up in a lot of the dukkha, the suffering of it. And then every once in a while, it would clear. My mind would be open and spacious and aware. And then sometime later, it would get caught in the suffering. And watching this cycle many times, I was watching myself with amazement. Here I was with this choice. Suffering, peace. Oh, let's suffer. And I just watched my mind doing that again and again. And it was so strange. You know, why do we do that? It's just out of habit. We need to decondition that tendency, that habit in our minds. Reflecting on the truth of impermanence can be a tremendous help. In the very early years of my practice, this goes back just to the late 60s in India, I was practicing, at that time there were very few Westerners, I was practicing just with one or two other people. I was quite young, so I was, here I was in India, you know, strange food, strange lands, not much support, there weren't any retreats going on at that time, I was just more or less practicing on my own and going to see my teacher Munindra once in a while. And I would be getting caught up, you know, in discouragement and when things were difficult, getting a little depressed, just all the usual stuff that comes up. And I remember at one point going through a particularly difficult period, and I started reflecting to myself, in 6 months, will I even remember this mind state? No. And then I thought, in 4 months, in 1 month, in 2 weeks, will I even remember it? No. And as I just was reflecting on the impermanence of the present mind state, the whole mind got and the heart just relaxed and became more easeful. What's so amazing about the seductive power of the world is that when we look back at our experience, when we look back at our past experience, we can see very easily and very clearly the dreamlike nature of it all. You know, the experiences we had a year ago, or 6 months ago, or this morning, where are they now? You know, we're so involved and caught up in our dramas, and yet the next hour, the next day, the next month, they're just this distant memory. So when we look back at our experience, we can all see this, we understand this. This is not hard to see and hard to understand. Yet when we look ahead, it's as if we're continually entranced by the possibilities. You know, and so we live our lives always toppling forward or leaning forward or anticipating the next hit of experience. You know, and it might be the next vacation or the next project or the next relationship or the next meal or it could be the next breath even. Forgetting that all those experiences will also soon be passed, and they'll be just like all the others. And this kind of dreamlike thing that happened without any real substance. Even during the early days of the retreat here, have you had any fantasies at all about the first thing you're going to do when you leave? You know, meeting your partner or your friends or having the food you want or sleeping in your own bed or whatever. And yet all these things we're looking forward to at the end of the retreat they too are soon going to be past. They'll be like all the other past experiences. And what also happens as we get older, and I think many of you will have experienced this, that all of this passing show seems to be going by more and more quickly. Somebody commented that by the time she turned 55, breakfast was happening every 15 minutes. You know, isn't it like that? I mean, you turn around and it's breakfast again. The great paradox of the spiritual life is that as objects of wanting, as objects of desire, all these changing experiences leave us ultimately unfulfilled, precisely because they're changing. You know, we have the experience of the moment and it's gone. So as objects of desire or craving, they always leave us unfulfilled. Yet as objects of mindfulness, the very same experiences, as objects of mindfulness rather than as objects of craving, actually become the vehicle for our awakening. So it's these very same experiences related to in a different way. We can learn deeply the truth of change, really learn it profoundly from the ordinary experiences of our lives. So it's not a question of pulling away or disengaging. It's a question of not holding on. And in English, there's a very useful distinction between two phrases, two words, that are often used interchangeably, really mean quite different things. So in a lot of Buddhist teachings, we hear a lot, or the word is used a lot, detachment. We should become detached. But that's not exactly accurate. It's not detached. A better word to describe this process is non-attachment. Because detachment implies a pulling back. It implies a certain indifference to what's going on. Non-attachment is being fully engaged with the experience, but not clinging to it, not holding on to it. These are two very different states, very different experiences. Liberating insight into impermanence comes in so many ways and on so many different levels. Now, just from the study or learning from science, we can learn about the birth and death of galaxies, you know, and of clusters of galaxies, these huge, you know, phenomena in nature, also come into being and live their very long lives and die. Down to the energy movements of, you know, subatomic particles. I was reading one article which was describing just what goes on within an atom, you know, within the nucleus of an atom. I can't even remember all the names of these particles, quarks and strange names. They're measuring things on that level in trillionths of a trillionth of a second. I mean, is that unbelievable? I mean, a second is pretty quick. A trillionth of a trillionth of a second, and this is what they're measuring, is how quickly things are moving on that level. And this is the basic building blocks of our whole world. How can we possibly think that there's anything which is fixed and solid and stable when the ultimate or more ultimate constituents, you know, of our world are changing at that rate? So it's true that in our ordinary perception, we're not seeing things in trillionths of a second. So we kind of have to take it on faith that these experiments are accurate. But one of the things that happens in meditation is that what I call the NPMs go way up. And NPMs are noticings per minute. You know. So when we start practice, our NPMs are pretty low. You know, maybe we notice 10 things a minute or 15, and then we're probably lost in our thought for quite a few minutes. And then, but as the mindfulness gets stronger and the concentration gets a bit stronger and the mind gets more steady, we begin to have many, many noticings per minute, you know, hundreds or maybe even thousands. Because when we're really feeling things carefully, just the very ordinary experiences we have, you know, I think the other day, just illustrated with the bell. How many oscillations, how many different vibrations are happening in a minute? If our minds are quiet, we're actually noticing all that. Or within one breath. You know, how many different sensations are happening within one breath? Many. So when we're quiet enough, you know, and interested enough, we begin to see for ourselves, it's not just the reports from science, we see for ourselves the rapidity of change that's happening. Really, on this level, we begin to drop from the world of concepts into a very different way of perceiving the world. So just as an example of this, think of the time, last time you went to a really good movie. You know, you go to the movies and very engaging story, and we're really caught up in the story with all the feelings and emotions. You know, and that's the whole point of going to the movies, to get caught up. It's interesting because it really shows the great seductive power of delusion. I mean, it's enjoyable on some level, and that's why we get so caught in it. But if we happen to remember to be mindful, even for a few moments in the movie, we begin to remember in those moments, oh, there's nobody up there falling in love or getting chased or dying. It's just pixels of light. You know, it's just patterns of light and color on the screen. There's no one up there. Nothing is really happening at all. And then if you really want to stretch your mind a bit, what happens to the light? What happens to the experience of the light if there's no screen on which it lands? How do we know there's light? Because it lands on an object. That's why if we look out into deep space, the light is not there, even though the energy of the sun is pouring out, but we don't see it as light because it's not landing on anything. So this is kind of just a little side excursion of my mind. But it's a possible good example of what the unborn means. You know, in many Buddhist texts, we read of the unborn, the undying, the deathless. Okay, we'll just leave it at that. But even just seeing that the story on the screen is not really happening, that it's just, you know, it's just these patterns of light. This doesn't mean that we disengage from the stories of our lives, which are like the movie. You know, we are engaged with it in our relationships, in our work. But if we can also see on a deeper level, where we really see the momentary change that's going on, we begin to live in the relative world with much greater ease, with less attachment and with less suffering. Wisdom also comes from paying attention to impermanence in ways that we already know, but often overlook. And these can become real daily life meditations. When we pay attention, we see the changes happening all around us. We see it in the changes of nature, you know, the changes of the season, the changes of the weather. The year, perfect lesson in change. From hour to hour, the weather is changing. You know, the huge changes of the environment, the climate change, which is affecting the whole planet. It's not stable. It's not staying the way we would like it to stay. We see the rise and fall of whole civilizations. I enjoy reading history a lot because it's such a reminder of the changing nature of things. Some years ago, I read a really interesting book. It was a biography of Genghis Khan. And of course I had, you know, read about him a little bit in junior high school or high school, but didn't know very much. So this biography was fascinating. I mean, he rose from just a small, you know, nomadic tribe, very poor. He basically conquered all of Asia and some of Europe. And I mean, he was probably the most important person in the world of his time. And yet now, you know, maybe we have some dim recognition of his name. That's what's left. And so Genghis Khan has become a little mantra for me. Whenever I need to remind myself of the impermanence of things, Genghis Khan. I do this particularly in the States when I start losing my equanimity a little bit over American politics, which is a true test. I can be lying in bed at night, kind of, Genghis Khan. And it really helps. I say, oh yeah, it's just part of the passing show. Now, in the forests around IMS in New England, you can be walking in the woods and there are miles and miles of stone walls because it all used to be farmland. But it's really very stony ground, so not very good for farming. So, you know, when the farmers finally realized that going to the Midwest would be more productive, the fields just grew back into forests, and there's a lot of rain there, so the forest grew very quickly. So you're walking through the woods, and just miles of stone walls and old stone foundations of houses that have been abandoned. And you just, you know, you walk there and you think of all the lot. First, the enormous amount of work to create those walls, and then the houses and the people lived in them, who were living lives as vivid and as compelling to them as ours is to us. And yet what's left? You know, some stone walls and old stone foundations. And of course in Europe, you know, with so many thousands of years of history, it's all around. You know, it can't help but be reminded of the impermanence of things. But do we pay attention? Do we take that in? Of course we can look even closer and impermanence when we look at our own bodies and minds, you know, or the changing experience of our relationships, you know, our work. We see that everything is disappearing and new things are arising not only every 100 years and not only every year or every month or every day, but actually in each moment. Things are disappearing and arising in every single moment. So a little experiment, if you can remember this from this point till the end of the talk, and this will be a challenge for you. At the end of the talk, just as a little meditative exercise, pay attention as you go from sitting to standing and then walking and leaving the hall. Pay attention to the flow of your experience. How many different sensations are involved in just standing? And then standing and you're walking and there are changing colors. You know, what we're seeing is changing, and then sounds are arising and passing, and maybe a thought, and then the sensations of the movement. Paying attention to just that very simple aspect of experience of standing up and leaving the hall, you can see thousands of changes taking place. And you don't have to leave the hall creeping along either. You can leave at a normal pace, so everybody behind you can leave the hall. But just pay attention to your experience. Pay attention to the changing experience that's happening. And we'll see, it's very obvious that things are changing and nothing lasts. The truth of this, though, is so ordinary that we mostly overlook it. It's not that it's a special meditative experience. This is just life. This is how it's all happening. But because it's so ordinary, we don't pay attention to it. And so we miss the chance, the everyday chance, to really free our minds through seeing the wisdom of this impermanence. The clearer we see this, the more clearly we see the impermanence, the less we cling. The less we cling, grasp, the less we suffer. Ajahn Chah expressed this, you know, so clearly and beautifully. He was a great Thai forest master. He said, if you let go a little, you will have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you will have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace. Your struggles with the world will have come to an end. So don't underestimate the importance of seeing impermanence on all of these levels. It's a liberating insight. One of the great monks of Burma, he lived just around the turn of the 1800s and 1900s, lived at the beginning of the 20th century. His name was Ledi Sayadaw. That's L-E-D-I. Ledi Sayadaw. A great meditation master and great Buddhist scholar, and many, many wonderful Dharma teachings and writings. He said, not seeing arising and passing away is ignorance, while seeing all phenomena as impermanent is the doorway to all the stages of insight and awakening. So that's how important this insight is. Not seeing the arising and passing away of phenomena is ignorance, while seeing the impermanence is the doorway to all the stages of insight and awakening. Sometimes careful observations of some other obvious truths can jolt us, can shock us out of the complacency of our lives, out of these deeply rooted habit patterns of holding on and attachment. And perhaps the most obvious and most overlooked reflection is that the end of birth is death. Okay, so that should be completely obvious to everyone, that our life is only getting shorter and shorter. But so often our awareness of death seems limited to other people. You know, we're aware of other people, either very close to us or not so close, of other people dying. But how often do we reflect on our own deaths? Do we really think about this? Do we really take this in? In the great Indian epic, the Mahabharata, one of the wise sages in this epic work, someone asked this sage, what's the most remarkable thing in the world? And the sage replied that we see other people dying all around us, and yet we don't think it will happen to us. You know? And so even though we intellectually know it will happen, there's some deep place in us that doesn't really let that in. I mean, how many of you spend time contemplating your own death? It's not something we're taught to do, and it's even some people might find it morbid or depressing. And yet it's not, it's liberating, because it's a reflection on what is true. What's so surprising, given that impermanence is all around us, is that we still find change surprising. You know, that in so many ways in our lives, we count on things staying a certain way. Or maybe if we've opened a little bit to the truth of change, we acknowledge that things may change, but it will change according to our liking. I want to read something that's really a little bit intense, but a very powerful teaching. And this is, I think most of you have heard of our teacher Dipa Ma, this amazing woman who died some years ago. She lived in Calcutta, and my first teacher, Munindraji, trained her in Burma. They were both in Burma at the time. She had just an amazing life story. She just went up to the fourth grade in education, was married, according to the custom at that time, betrothed at 12, married at 14. She had three children, two of whom died quite young. And after, it was a very happy marriage. At one point, her husband died, and she said that she was just thrown into this tremendous grief. The grief was so overwhelming. She said she was in bed for 5 years. You know, she was devastated by the loss of her children, the loss of her husband. Out of desperation at the whole time, she thought and her friends thought she was going to die from this. They said, you must go to one of the monasteries, the meditation centers in Burma. Only that can really help you. So she ended up going to one of the monasteries, and she was this extraordinary being. Within a very short time, she had attained very high stages of enlightenment, had developed concentration to the highest degree, what are called the absorptions of the jhanas, and developed what in the Buddhist literature and teachings, all the different psychic powers, you know, what are called the supernormal powers that can happen from states of concentration. And there's a wonderful book of her life called Dipa Ma, which, if you're interested at all, I would recommend. And it tells a lot of these stories of what she accomplished. Quite amazing. And she was this just incredibly loving being. She lived in this very poor section of Calcutta. She lived with her surviving daughter in just two rooms. Very poor. But we would go up to her room and it would be like being bathed in light, you know, and she would just run her hands over, you know, our heads and shoulders and blessing, and just this amazing feeling of metta. And so she was extraordinary. But she was also, she could be very fierce in an incredibly loving way. So I want to read something, and this came from the book. It was written by a student of hers in Calcutta. And it's pretty direct. When my son died in 1984, this is from a woman named Sudipti. When my son died in 1984, Dipa Ma shocked me with her words. It was a hard teaching I have not forgotten. She said, "Today your son has gone from this world. Why are you shocked? Everything is impermanent. Your life is impermanent. Your husband is impermanent. Your son is impermanent. Your money is impermanent. Everything is impermanent. There is nothing that is permanent. When you were alive, you might think, this is my daughter, my husband, my property. But when you are dead, nothing is yours. Sudipti, you think you are a serious meditator, but you must really learn that everything is impermanent. Now, this is an incredible teaching. I mean, this is somebody who had just lost their son. But Deepama wasn't speaking theoretically. I mean, she was speaking from having gone through that loss and that grief and come to the deepest level of realization. Everything is impermanent. Can we really take that in, you know, on some deep, deep level? And it's interesting just to notice that Deepama didn't say, why are you sad? Which, of course, would be natural. She said, why are you shocked? So that's important to realize. It's not to deny the natural emotions that come. But we shouldn't be shocked. We shouldn't be surprised by this. Because impermanence is the nature of everything. It characterizes everything. But we like to just take the parts of that truth that we like. You know? We really have to see it in its completion. That's why when she says, Deepama said, Sudipti, you think you are a serious meditator. You really have to learn that everything is impermanent. So that's the depth of this. This is not just some superficial insight about our lives. So we need to reflect on it. We need to really let it in, you know, in deeper and deeper ways. And then to see, does it inspire us? Does it frighten us? You know, we have to work with whatever reactions or responses or emotions come in the face of this truth, but it's not to deny it, you know, or avoid it, if we really want to be free. Now, given the truth of death, what does this say about how we live our lives, about the choices we make? One experiment, kind of a mind experiment that I like to make, and it's been a very useful exercise. I like and find it fruitful to imagine myself on my deathbed. And I give myself a little leeway here because I'm in bed. And we don't know how we're going to die. But just for the purpose of the experiment, okay, let me be comfortable in bed. But I'm dying. That's the key point. Okay, so I'm in bed dying. And I really try to imagine it, you know, just to imagine that in the body being sick and weak and, you know, in that process. And then to reflect from that viewpoint, from that perspective, to reflect on what would I have wanted to have done in my life? You know, to reflect from that viewpoint on, well, what's really of value? And of course, the important thing is to ask this question now. Because if we wait until we're dying, it's too late. You know, we will have lived out our lives just living out the habit patterns of our conditioning. But it's possible, if we reflect on this great truth of change very immediately now, it actually can influence our choices. And we can make wiser choices. There are many examples of wisdom, and beautiful examples of wisdom in the face of death. I recently listened to an audiobook. It was a biography of the great American Lakota Sioux Indian Crazy Horse. I know you've heard his name. He was one of the last great Indian warriors in America, and he was also a mystic, a very spiritual being. And he expressed a wonderful understanding of just the natural cycles of birth and life and death. And one of the statements or teachings he was most known for, he said, "Today is a good day to die. for all the things of my life are present. This is such an interesting notion. Today is a good day to die, for all the things of my life are present. Now, it's a wonderful sense of wholeness and completion and acceptance. Very different than how many of us might feel. You know, would we be able to say today is a good day to die? No, I have so much more to do. So something, we haven't come to that place of wholeness yet. So I find that quite inspiring. Another expression of this wisdom of truly understanding impermanence in the face of death is something I've referred to a lot over these years in Dharma talks, and some of you may have heard me refer to this before, but it's such a striking example of an amazing wisdom, and it's about the great American naturalist Henry David Thoreau. I don't know, is he familiar? Very famous in the States. Wonderful writer. He wrote Walden Pond. And he was a great naturalist in the 1800s. But he died very young. He died at 44 from tuberculosis. So not a pleasant way. It's a very hard disease. And so this was written by some friends, by a friend of his, describing Thoreau during his dying days, and it's quite remarkable. He said, Henry was never affected by his illness. Very often I've heard him tell his visitors that he enjoyed existence as well as ever. In this sentence, he remarked to me that there was as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health, because the mind always conforms to the condition of the body. Now that's an amazing insight. There is as much comfort in perfect disease as in perfect health, because the mind always conforms to the condition of the body. He's really talking about the nature of awareness. The awareness simply knows whatever is there, but the awareness is not affected. Perfect disease, perfect health, the awareness remains the same. So this is quite extraordinary, you know, and a great, for me, inspiration and challenge. You know, even short of the dying moments, just when we're a little sick, how are our mind? Is there as much comfort in that disease as when we're in perfect health? Usually not. But there's that possibility. He said the thought of death could not begin to trouble him. During his long illness, I never heard a murmur escape him or the slightest wish expressed to remain with us. His perfect contentment was truly wonderful. None of his friends seemed to realize how very ill he was, so full of life and good cheer did he seem. One friend, as if by way of consolation, said to him, "Well, Mr. Thoreau, we must all go." Henry replied, "When I was a very little boy, I learned that I must die. So of course I am not disappointed now. Death is as near to you as it is to me." Some of his more orthodox friends and relatives tried to prepare him for death, but with little satisfaction to themselves. When his aunt Louisa asked him if he had made his peace with God, he answered, "I did not know we had ever quarreled, aunt." So it's quite an amazing understanding, you know, and for me it's a tremendous inspiration for what's possible when we have really understood the truth of impermanence. You know, and for Thoreau, that insight, that wisdom came through his intimate connection with nature. You know, he might never have sat a meditation retreat, but this truth of impermanence is all around us. The liberating power of seeing this, seeing it deeply, is expressed in one very startling statement of the Buddha, where he said, it's better to live a single day seeing the arising and passing of phenomena than to live 100 years without seeing it. So I find that extraordinary. You know, with all the wonderful things we might do with our lives, the Buddha is saying, it's better to live a single day seeing the rapid arise and passing of phenomena than to live 100 years doing whatever it is that we do without seeing it. Why? Because the power of seeing impermanence on this level is so liberating. That's what frees the mind. That's the sword of wisdom that actually can cut through the deep patterns of attachment and clinging. There are many places in the Buddha's teachings, you know, when you read the discourses, where the Buddha will just say one simple thing and then the whole room gets enlightened. So I'm about to pass on one of these teachings. This is your chance. So it's very simple. It's a very simple teaching. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. Whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. What has the nature to arise? Everything. Can you see the power of that, even if we just glimpse it a little bit? That whatever in our life has the nature to arise, which is everything that happens in our lives, whatever it is, has also the nature to pass away. Nothing is going to last. Can we get that? As we reflect on it, and as particularly we see it, and this is one of the gifts of a meditation retreat, where you have nothing else to do during the day except to notice the impermanence of things. That's what this practice is all about. You know, it's not about... it's not about anything you think it's about. It's not about having some great meditative experience or some wonderful meditative state or whatever. Because whatever has the nature to arise will also pass away. That's what we need to see. And it's not hard to see, because it's happening all the time with everything. We just have to look. We just have to open our eyes to be seeing it and reflecting on it. And then it has this tremendously transformative power in our lives. You know, we see that everything is just part of a passing show. It's like the current, the flow of a river, or water over a waterfall. Do you ever watch, I'm sure you do, you know, at times, just watch water coming over a waterfall. Just the endlessness, you know, of the flow. That's what our lives are like. But we need to see it. We really need to see it directly and intimately. And what's interesting, as we see this truth of impermanence, just on a moment-to-moment level and on bigger levels, in every way that we see it, what happens is it reorients us towards loving-kindness and care rather than clinging and attachment. Now, it reorients us towards letting go rather than holding on. There was a Japanese nun who was the abbess of a nunnery. And she had a beautiful expression, statement of her enlightenment, her awakening. I'd just like to close with this. Her name was Teijitsu. She lived in a Zen monastery, Zen nunnery, in the 18th century. She saw that all phenomena arose, abided, and fell away. She saw that the knowing of this arose, abided, and fell away. Then she knew there was nothing more than this. No ground, nothing to lean on, stronger than the cane she held. Nothing to lean upon at all, and no one leaning. And she opened the clenched fist in her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. Yeah, that's such a beautiful. She let go. She opened the clenched fist. That's like this. She opened the clenched fist of her mind and let go and fell into the midst of everything. And so this is our practice.